We talk about conflict resolution in marriage. I mean, these are tools that we have got to have. Occasionally, you'll hear a couple or a man may, I don't know that I've ever heard a woman say this, but a man will sometimes say, now, in our marriage, we've never had an argument. I don't think you should buy a used car from that man because he may not be telling the truth. Why do you think that we have conflicts in marriage? Well, it's not so complicated. I mean, the fact is, and we ended the session last night from 1 Corinthians chapter 13, talking about love, and love endures all things. Why would you have a chapter about love and say about enduring all things? And it's because you're dealing with human beings. But furthermore, we're two different genders. There is as much beauty in design in the male and female genders that God created as there is in the constellations. God knew what He was doing, and we complete each other. We need each other. It's not good that man should be alone, and for that reason God made the woman, and we correspond to each other. But we're different, and because of that, sometimes there's going to be conflict. Now, it's unfair to paint conflict in marriage all the same way because it's not all the same. Conflict is very different. And I'm going to start, we're going to do four levels. What you have on your note page that I created is just the first level because we had to do things in sevens for this lectureship. I'm going to do about 20, but there's seven at the beginning. So anyway, it'll go beyond there. I want to do, as time will permit, and I understand that I have 50 minutes. Do I have 50 minutes?
Yes.
Great. David, okay? 45? It was Gary who took the time. Okay, that's fine. That'll be just fine. I will divide this into four categories. And the first one is the biggest one. And the reason is because most of us in this room are Christians. And among Christian couples, the first category is where most of our conflict comes. It's not serious stuff. It's frustrations. It's pressure that is naturally going to be present in our lives. It's a really great thing, you know, if one of you can have pressure and the other one be relaxed, and then sometimes it's the other way around. It's on those days when both of you are feeling pressured that you know, come home and, oh, it's not very pleasant. So what we want to do is to not let that grow bigger than it should. And I'm not a very good plumber. I do it sometimes. We came home from speaking somewhere recently, and I went downstairs, and we have a semi-finished basement. We have a lot of things stored down there and stuff, and my clock shop is down there. And I went down, and I was working on something, and I heard this strange sound. It was kind of a psss sound. And I started looking for it, and it was one of the copper water pipes, and it had a little pinhole in it, and it was doing this spray thing. Well, I had to get back on another plane in a few hours. I mean, I had a very short amount of time. And so I can do this. And I cut a section out, you know, and sweated the pipe and failed. I failed. And it was a mess. And then I paid somebody, you know, to come and do it. If you start working on plumbing, you may have a little leak that springs into seven leaks. And that's, you know, you think you have it fixed, then you put pressure to it. Anyway, I don't want that to happen in your marriage. So here's what we're going to do. I was invited to come and speak, and you paid your money to come and be part of this session, so I have the authority to make the rules, and I'm going to make the rules. All right? Seven rules. Here they are. We're talking about this first level, level one of conflict in our marriages, and the most popular level of conflict in our marriages in this room are the ones where we simply have frustrations and we take it out on each other. Here are the rules. Number one, let's see if I can do this clicker. I don't know what I'm doing. Let's see, how's this? I am mechanical. All right, here's the first rule. Don't pretend you can read minds. You know how this works out? Well, the Bible talks about it, you know, in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 11. No man knows the things that are in a man save the spirit of man that is in him. And sometimes, you know, we get in a little tiff together, and one of you says, I know what you're thinking. No, you don't. You know, you think you do, but you don't. And it's kind of insulting, right? Or how about this? I love this one. How about, well, if you don't know, I'm not going to tell you. You know what? Your spouse And listen to me, because this is important. Your spouse cannot logically or reasonably deal with the difficulty that you're feeling if you don't say it. And you got to say it in a way that is clear and understandable. Here's what I'm really upset about. Do you ever have a discussion, a little discomfort, little fuss, and you go way deep into that thing, and one of you says, "Wait a minute, that's what this is about?" Because it just hasn't been communicated. Sometimes what it's about is not what it's about. All right, your spouse can't read minds. I asked Cindy if I could have permission to tell you this story. I wouldn't have told you if she hadn't have said okay, but she said okay. Take my word for that. I'm sitting at the table, working at my computer. And she goes over to the pantry. She's getting ready to go to ladies' night out. And she said, "Who ate the Lay's potato chips that I brought to take to ladies' night out?" And I thought, I'm the only other one in the house. I mean, how many people can it be? It's not her. And I said, "Well, it was. I mean, they were good too. They were good." I said, "Well, honey, it was me. I ate them. I was going to take those to ladies' night out." "Well, honey, you didn't tell me. And they were in the pantry. That's where we keep food. The pantry." All right. So here's rule number one. Don't expect your spouse to read minds. And if you want a lot of this stuff, you know, if you could just say it in a way that is kind, but here's what's bothering me. And just be clear about it, because you can't deal with it if it's not clear. All right, here's number two. Ready? Don't get historical. All right. You know how this old joke goes. One man said to the other, "Every time my wife gets mad at me, she gets historical." You mean hysterical? No, I mean historical. She brings up everything I ever did. All right. Why do we do this? Why do we, if we get in a little argument, why do we bring up the errors or mistakes of the past? I think the reason typically is that we feel, we're having this little argument, my side, your side, and we start to feel like that our arguments are getting kind of weak, and it's like, pass me some ammunition. And so I reach back into the bone pile of history, and I say, "Oh, well, you know what? I remember when you did this, and it's a lot worse than what I just did." Right? Or I can think of three different times in the last 4 weeks that you, and it may be something that I have done, and that I shouldn't have done it, I shouldn't have said it, I shouldn't have said it that way, or whatever it is, but I apologize for it, and we finished that. It was over with. And to bring it up now, frankly, is not the way that I want to be treated. How many times does the golden rule come into effect, or should it come into play, when dealing with our marriage? I don't want these issues. These are trivial. I mean, in the great scheme of things, the kinds of stuff we're talking about right now are trivial things. Let's don't give them any more life than they deserve. Let's deal with them in a right way, in a loving way, and let's get rid of these uncomfortable issues. And one is, don't get historical. Now, is there a time when it's right to get historical? The answer to that is yes. If you have a sin that has elbowed its way into your relationship, into your marriage, and it's a reoccurring problem, sometimes you cannot deal with that without revisiting history. For example, if we're talking about alcohol or drug use, it would be important to say, "Honey, I smell alcohol on your breath. And, you know, we've been working on that for this long." In other words, you have to revisit history to say, we've got a problem here and we're going to have to work on it in a larger way. Or maybe it's pornography. How many women's wives' hearts have just been shattered by accidentally coming in and hitting a key on a computer and these naked women come up and then her mind does this gamut where she goes through how could this be and where did this come from and why is this on the screen? And then it just all comes clear. She knows exactly what has happened. And sometimes it is appropriate to go back and say to her husband, "You know, this is a habit. This thing we talked about before, but it keeps coming back." So anyway, we're talking about primarily the frustration kinds of fusses that occur in marriage. And the second rule is don't get historical. Here's the next one. Don't exaggerate. Oh, do you do this? Do you do it? Proverbs 31 says the heart of her husband does safely trust in her. Exaggeration is a form of lying. And we do it in order to substantiate the argument that we're making. But of course, it doesn't do that. It just makes matters worse. How do we, if we're fussing with our wives or our husbands, how do we do this? How about, I love this. You always do this. Is that true? I mean, do we mean, you never do this. Well, typically that's an exaggeration. In order to substantiate my point, it isn't really true. And it exacerbates this whole fuss. It makes it worse because it hurts feelings. How about this one, where you repeat something your husband said or your wife said that was inappropriate, but when you repeat it, you do some historic revisionism. You say it in a way that casts it in a worse light than it was originally said. You know what you said? You said, I don't like your hair. Well, honey, I didn't say that. Yes, you did. No, I didn't say it like that. I wouldn't have said it. I didn't say it like that. Well, we don't have a recorder, right? All right. I'm here to tell you that if you want to minimize these arguments, we don't want the sun to go down on our wrath. Ephesians 4:26. Don't let that happen. We don't want these little fusses that really are born of frustration. It's not really about what it's about. We don't want to let them grow. It's stupid to let them grow into something. Why should we let this go past right now? But can we talk about this and then we settle it? I love you. Forgive me. I'm sorry. Incidentally, when you say you're sorry, it's a good thing to say, will you forgive me? You know, let's just clean this up and let's go on and love each other. All right, let's do the next one. Here's the next rule. Number four. Keep this between us. There are a couple of reasons why it's wrong to argue in front of your children. Two reasons I can think of. One is that you're training your boy in how to be a husband. You're training your little girl in how to be a wife. And it seems to me that when we argue, there's something, a dynamic that goes on that you're kind of losing control of here. And I don't want to leave to chance the kind of training of my children with reference to marriage. I want to be level-headed and talk to them about marriage, but I don't want to leave that to this shotgun kind of approach of letting them hear us argue. Take it somewhere else. You're grown-ups. And I tell you something else, too. Sometimes in marriage, you'll have one spouse who will take little digs at the other because he or she knows the other won't reciprocate if the children are there. You know, you say something kind of sharp because you can get away with it. He's not going to say anything in front of those kids, right? Don't do that. Take it somewhere else. Go and talk about it somewhere else. The second reason you shouldn't argue in front of your children is because you don't know what you're doing to their insides. I'm telling you, your kids know other kids who come from broken homes. And maybe yours is a broken home already, but if it's not, you know, I don't want to rob my children of the security that they really need. You suppose it's important for my children, your children, to see mom and daddy hugging and talking kindly to each other? You know, so what does it do inside of a child when they hear sharp words exchanged between their parents? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know about this chiseling away at something in their core, but I don't want to do it. I don't want to take the chance of that. Let's keep this between us. And we're talking about at this level of just the frustration, little tiff. Let's keep it between us. And at this level, I don't think we should get on the phone and talk to other people about it either. There's a level at which we should take it outside, but this isn't it. The problem with you know, you get on the phone and you say, I'm going to tell you what she said after that. Yeah, I told her this. Or maybe it's the other way around. The wife is saying, mother, let me tell you what he said. Well, yeah, I told him this. Well, he made me so mad. No, I'm not going to sleep with him. See, the problem with that is that When you fix it, and you know, your tempers go down, and now you're okay, and you love each other again. The problem is you got somebody else to talk to. You got to clean it up with this other person. And it enlarges the issue. I don't want us to do that. At this level, let's just keep this between us. And let's keep it away from the children. All right, rule number 5. Don't manipulate with sex. Pardon me, on the recording they're going to wonder why I'm choking on that one. Don't manipulate with sex. The Bible is really, really clear about this in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And here's the way the sexual, the intimate part of marriage is described. He says, when you get married, and I'm paraphrasing, your body doesn't belong to you, it belongs to him. His body doesn't belong to him, it belongs to her. And so that is to the degree that when intimacy is withheld, deliberately withheld from the spouse, the King James says, I don't want you to defraud one the other. Do you know what defraud means? I was in a court of law a few years ago because some people had broken into our church building and had stolen some things in the night. They were druggies and they wanted anything they could steal. What can you steal from a church? Maybe they thought we had some cash. We didn't. But anyway, I had to go to court and just testify that I did not give these people permission to come into our building in the middle of the night. But I heard another case that preceded ours, and it was somebody who was shoplifting. And the judge let him have it. And why, he said, are you defrauding our merchants here in Blacksburg? Why don't you go back home where you came from and defraud those merchants back there? And I thought about this passage in 1 Corinthians 7. It's about sex in marriage, and it says, don't defraud one the other. To defraud is to take something that doesn't belong to you. Never, ever put sex on the table as a bargaining chip or as a, I mean, unless you do it playfully, I'm okay with doing that. But as a pry bar to get your way, never do that. I had a friend a few years ago who, they're not Christians, and just a fine fella, and he said, his heart was breaking. He said, I was with my wife last night at this rather expensive dress store, and she was looking at dresses, and she wanted a very expensive dress, and she showed it to me, and she said, if you'll buy this for me, I will. And he said, and it just killed him. He said, you know, there's a word for that. And they eventually divorced. Don't manipulate with sex. Let me tell you something. If you believe the Bible, you know that your body doesn't belong to you. It belongs to your spouse. And intimacy is never to be used. You know, you say, well, I'm mad at him. And when he starts doing things the way I want him to, then I will be back with him again. But he should not expect the joy and warmth and comfort of a wife's arms until he does what I want. That's just as sinful as it can be. That's just as sinful as it can be. And you know what? I recommend that you take that spirit. You ought to buy some stock in the Kleenex company because you're going to need a right smart amount of it. All right, here's number 6. This is a good one. Apologize well. Do not offer apologies that are stamped Hong Kong on the bottom. You know how we do that? Have you ever done this in your marriage where you have a little argument? Your feelings are kind of hurt. And you know that you said something. Maybe, you know, he said something he shouldn't have said, or she said something she shouldn't have said. But I know I bear a little responsibility. I know I bear some responsibility. So I say, I'm sorry. I just want to say I'm sorry. But I did it because, and then I have this string of mitigating reasons why it was justifiable. I did it because it made sense to do it, but I'm sorry anyhow. You know what you can keep? You can just keep that apology. Keep it. It's cheap and worthless, and it's not going to help this thing get over. Right? Keep it. Who would you suppose offered the cleanest, best apology in the New Testament? The prodigal son, I think. Father, I've sinned against heaven and before thee. I'm no more worthy to be called thy son. Don't you suppose there were some mitigating circumstances he could have offered? I'm telling you something. I'm real sorry. Daddy, I'm sorry I did it, but it was driving me crazy to live with all of your rules, and all of my friends were moving out and I couldn't move out, and I'm sorry. Keep it. Just keep it. If you're going to offer an apology, the rule is offer a good one or just don't make it at all. Right? All right. Here's the seventh one. Keep your faith. Don't ever, ever let, no matter how difficult problems in marriage may become for you, you must never, ever let it rob you of your relationship with Jesus Christ. Galatians 6, 1 and 2. Brethren, if any man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness. Then he adds this, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted. I need to be careful in my life to hold on to my faith. And sometimes, you know, you remember what 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7 says, likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them, your wives, according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. You suppose conflict with your spouse might hinder your prayers? Could if you let it. Don't turn loose of your faith. No matter what your spouse does, and no matter how difficult marriage may become, you be sure that you're faithful to your Lord, because you've got to stand in the judgment day by yourself. Do you hear what I'm saying? Don't let this interfere with your faith. You make your faith, keep your faith strong. All right, that's the first level. Now let's go to the second level. Each one becomes progressively more difficult. This level is a problem that keeps resurfacing. This may be a number of different possibilities of things that just, it's kind of like you cut your arm on something, and you know you doctor it up and you bandage it, and it's getting better. It's almost healed. But what if coincidentally you cut it right at the same place again? And you know you doctor it up, but what if that happens several times on the same spot? Listen, you're going to have a problem on your arm. And so it is with marriage. The next level is kind of a rut. I think we're getting into a rut and we have this reoccurring problem. Maybe it has to do with temper. That when we disagree, his temper goes so far, cuts so deep, that it takes us days to get over it. He says things that are not just about what it's about, but he says things to insult my character and who I am. And he, you know, we used to say as kids, sticks and stones break my bones, but words shall never. That's a lie, you know. It's always been a lie. What if it's a reoccurring problem? What if it has to do, again, with some sort of alcohol or drug use or pornography? What if it's a reoccurring problem? At this level, we are probably going to need somebody to talk to. I don't think that even at this level, though, that you need to overemphasize it. And wouldn't it be great just to find someone in the church, maybe an elder, maybe one of the preachers, or maybe just someone in the church that you trust as being a godly man or woman, and saying, can we sit down and talk? Is there something that you can think of that I could be doing to help this? I need somebody who thinks outside of the pressure of what we're in right now to give me some advice. I don't think that's a bad thing. It's not a shameful thing. It's a good thing. Your objective is, I love my husband. I want us to be happy. I love my wife. I want us to be happy together, right? Sometimes the reoccurring problem is PMS. And some marriages have a really hard time with this. That, you know, there's the week before the cycle. There's the week of. Then there's the week after, and you have one good week, you know, and then it's going to resurface. And sometimes the way a man knows that and women are all different about this. I don't know much about this, except that I know that women are different. And some women have a real serious problem with it. Their emotions go wacko. And then some, you know, they don't have much trouble at all. The way a lot of husbands know when it's more severe, the way he knows, is not because of a calendar, but because of something he feels inside. Because she will say things to him that hurt him in a way that he doesn't feel in other times. He only feels, because she only says this depth of thing, when it's time for PMS. And so let's spend some time on that. Husbands, here are the rules. During this time, avoid the desire to resolve issues. It doesn't mean you're not going to discuss about the quarrels, the criticisms she's going to raise. But bear in mind that this is not a good time to try to resolve them. Discuss them with her. It's not a good time to try to resolve them. Things are going to change after the storm blows over. Let her be the one to initiate intimacy. Try to ease her workload. Don't minimize your faults in the temptation to blame all the problems on PMS. That one was hard for me. Because in a husband's mind, you know, you're dealing with this. You categorize it. Her contentions, are they serious and real? And am I the way that she's portraying me to be? And you have to say, well, I got to wait until this is over to ascertain that. At the same time, it's insulting to her to say, all this, all of it, is because of PMS. And I think that's a bad thing to say. All right. And incidentally, Mrs. Colley and I drew these up. Five, because I couldn't have written this by myself. Give her time away from the children. That one seems obvious, doesn't it? Help her. Pray about this. I'm going to leave that up just for another minute here. Any of this that you want, I'll be happy to email to you too if you'll just ask. All right, wives, during this time, be aware that PMS is not a license to sin. It's a temptation. It's a physical problem that creates an emotional problem that creates a temptation sometimes to sin. But it's not a license. Two, mark your calendar. Predict it. Three is a big one. Let me tell you something about your man. If you have problems emotionally during this time of month that causes upheaval in your marriage, if you fall into that category, I want you to know that this is hard to do, but it will just do so much good for your husband. If you could say to him, you know what, my difficult time is coming up on the calendar a couple of days from now. That's when I should probably hit the PMS, and so I just want to alert you to that. Now, what that does is free his mind. In this logical, black and white kind of mind that a man has, he can categorize that, and he kind of prepares himself for dealing with you gently. Where he gets problems, where he gets into real trouble, if this is PMS time, and he's dealing with it like you mean everything you say, that everything you say is exactly the way you say it, that this is all completely real. And when he starts reacting like that, suddenly things go cattywampus. If he knows that it's PMS time and you're going to have trouble with it, then he can categorize that and he can handle it better. Seek a physician's help. Very often the case that there are some mild, non-addictive drugs that can be very helpful, some Zoloft or some of those kinds of drugs. Five, pray about this. Six, exercise all through the month, especially during these days. That will be helpful. Seven, stay in God's book. Keep your faith strong. Eight, don't let it make you abusive towards your children or towards your husband. Wives, during this time, don't make important decisions. Don't overschedule yourself. Don't consume excessive caffeine. Don't express things that you can't stand about your husband. Just wait a little while. Please wait. Don't express those things to anyone except the Lord. Wait. Because as sure as you are that he is the devil incarnate, you know, if you'll just give this a little time, you may feel differently about it. Let the storm blow over. I'm putting this in the second category. Of those problems that there, I mean, we still love each other, and this is not about I think I'm going to divorce him or her. This is at the level, though, where this is a reoccurring problem. And so these are my suggestions. Now, level three. There are four total. Level three is we disagree about the Lord. The Bible acknowledges this kind of issue in a couple of different places. The one that is perhaps the most explicit in discussing what to do is 1 Peter chapter 3. In this passage, verses 1 through 7, it's a believing woman, a Christian woman, who is married to an unbelieving man. And he, as it's described, is not going to go to worship with her. He's not interested in talking about Christianity. He's not interested in talking about the Lord. That's outside of his sphere of interest. What can she do? I'm going to paraphrase 1 Peter chapter 3, but the answer is, he says, I want you to be submissive to him. That's very interesting. A wife is to be submissive to her husband. The only limitation to that is if what he requires of her conflicts with what Christ requires of her, she ought to obey Jesus, right? Jesus first, husband second. And this would bear that out. Having said that, the essence of it is you live in such a way as a Christian wife that you show him how good you are to him and that you are these ways because you're a Christian. You know, you're different. You're not like other men's wives. You're submissive and you're kind and you're good to me. You view sex as something that your body belongs to me and mine belongs to you. You have all these views that make marriage better for us. And I know where it came from. It came from the fact that you're a Christian. You deal with pain differently. You deal with anger differently. And I know you're not perfect, but this is the concept that you get in your mind. The best chance that you may have of bringing your husband to the Lord, or you can flip this over, bringing your wife to the Lord, is to live in front of them in such a way that they say, hey, you know what? This is a great way to live. I benefit from these things. I like this. And then gradually, hopefully, he or she will want to become a Christian too. What we need to be doing, of course, is talking to our kids and preparing them for the decision about marriage and to marry a Christian. I do not say to kids, I teach kids a lot. I love teaching kids. You know, I don't say, I want you to marry a member of the Church of Christ, because that's not enough. I do want them to marry a member of the Church of Christ, but that's not enough. I want them to marry somebody who loves Jesus, who fears God, you know, and I think there are ways that we can tell that. If we're in this mixed kind of marriage, what kind of problems are we talking about? Let's see. What kind of problems? We're talking about moral issues sometimes. If he's not a Christian, he may feel quite differently about alcohol consumption than I do. He may feel differently about language and the way that we use God's name. He may feel very differently about praying and thanking God for our food when we sit down to eat it. He may feel very differently about how weekends should be spent and how his wife should want to go to the lake with him on Sunday because that's the only day I have off. And I've got that boat. And I want you with me. All right? This could escalate. He may not understand that you're going to be in the Lord's house with the Lord's church on the Lord's day and how that's important to you. So, again, these kinds of issues can be, and you know what? I didn't think this was going to happen when I married her. I thought that she would become a Christian. Thank God so many people do become Christians when they marry Christians. And that's a wonderful thing. But many do not. And we need to teach our kids, just let them think about how it would be Sunday morning and Sunday night, middle of the week when we meet other times. And they're going to sit on the pew without that spouse. Get in the car by yourself and come to worship. And that may be descriptive of some of you. And I don't mean to pour salt in your wound. I just want to describe this as a third level because I think this is a bigger level than what we've talked about up to this point. This is about the fact that I can't talk about heaven with you. I mean, I can't get in the car after hearing David or Dan preach a great sermon and say, I thought this was a terrific point, or I'm going to apply this to my, I'm going to do better about this than I have, or what a wonderful application he made, or whatever. Number four, trust is broken. This is the worst, most difficult level. It is the hardest to get over. Trust can be broken a number of ways, and it's critical because you look at a great oak tree, and if you poison its root, the rest of the tree will die. The root of your marriage, of course, is trust. When sex is about trust. Intimacy is about, you know what intimacy means? It means inmost. It means that we have this trust, this bond. When Mary was told that she was going to have the Christ child, remember her reaction to that? How can this be, seeing I've known not a man? She was talking about sex, but isn't it interesting that it's couched in those terms? I've known not a man. Because marriage has this bond, and trust is the taproot of your marriage. You can't survive without it. But now you can get it back. When it's lost, it can be rekindled. It's just going to be very difficult and take a lot of time. It's interesting that lust can't live with loyalty. Trust can't live without it. What kinds of things break trust? I think that there are levels of temper that break trust. Physical abuse breaks trust. Sexual sins break trust. I think pornography clearly breaks trust. Sexual sin is in a class by itself with reference to sins. I know this for more than one reason. I've been preaching for 30, I don't know, some years. And in counseling, I began to realize over time that the most difficult sin for a person to forgive himself or herself of is sexual sin. I don't know why that's true. I just believe it's true. I think that you may have stolen or lied or cheated in some way or another, you know, and various different kinds of sins, but sexual sin is something that's in your psyche, and it's the most difficult to get rid of. It's the most difficult to forgive ourselves of. And so 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 18 says that a person who commits fornication, he sins against his own body. That's very interesting. I know that it's a very serious sin, because when Jesus was telling about marriage and divorce in the law, his law, in Matthew 19 and verse 9, only under one circumstance did he say you can divorce your mate, marry someone else, and still have God's approval. That's in the case of adultery. You put your spouse away for adultery. He didn't command people to do that. He gave license for people to choose to do that. Okay, so what do you do? Let's get real practical about this. I'm in favor of classes that are practical and not aloof. What can you do when you find that your spouse is involved in pornography or adultery, and your world is just shaken from its roots, and your trust is just zapped, it's just gone? How do you deal with that? Well, in the case of pornography, sometimes people ask me, in fact, pretty often, people will ask me about Matthew 19, 9 and Matthew 5 and 28. Matthew 19, 9 says that you can put away your spouse for fornication, marry another, and have God's approval. But does pornography fall into that category? Matthew 5 and 28 says, whoso looks on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. Question, if you find that your husband has been looking at pornography, does that mean that you have liberty to divorce him and remarry and have God's approval? The answer is no. The answer to that is no. The reason is that in Matthew 19 and verse 9, fornication is a physical act. The permission to put away your spouse for fornication, the Greek word porneia, is a physical act. That's not what's happened in Matthew 5 and 28. Pornography use will break trust, and it'll break her heart, or his heart, typically hers. And it's a terribly serious thing, but it's not adultery in the physical sense for which Jesus gave the the description about putting away your wife and remarrying. What if it's adultery? Let's just make the rules for adultery. My time is almost gone. What to do? Turn to God in prayer and Bible study. Don't you let this take away your faith. You say, my world's just come undone. That may be true, but you've got to go to judgment, you know. And you want to go to heaven. You can't go to hell no matter what. And you're going to stand in judgment by yourself. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10 says, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that every man may receive the things done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or evil. 2, decide if you want to rebuild or not. In the case of adultery, do you want to make a go of this? Can you make a go of this? I would parenthetically say that I hope you will. If your spouse ever commits adultery, I want you to try to make a go of it. There's a mighty good chance that your greatest potential for happiness in life is still to stay with that person, work it out, and come out on the other end strong again. Don't necessarily accept this notion that divorce is going to be the best option. It may not be. If you do want to make a go of it, expect this to take time inside of you and set conditions for the offending mate. I think this ought to be put on paper. I think that he or she ought to have to sign it. All right? So no ambiguity here. What kind of things do we want to put on that paper? It should be posted like, or suggested like this. You sit down together and you say, I've been praying about this and thinking about it after I learned about your adultery, your affair. I really love you and I hate you right now. But I tell you what, I will come back to you and we will make a go of this. But here are the stipulations. If there's any one of these that you won't agree to, I'm going to file and I'll do it this afternoon. What should be on the list? Number one, we're going to get some outside counseling. We're going to have another person to get involved in this to help work through this, right? Number two, you and I are going to be faithful to the worship assemblies. We're going to get involved with the Lord's church. Okay? Three, you're going to sever every connection with that person. I had a man say to me one time who had committed adultery and his life was in a terrible mess. And he said, you know, I don't know why my wife's so hard about this. She's insisting that I got to either quit my job or get out of that department where that woman is. And I know I did wrong. I know I made a mistake, but it's all past now. And I tell you what, I just have this vision that in the future, after the dust all settles, well, you know, that woman and her husband, why, could come over and have supper with my wife and me. And You're crazy. What planet does that happen on? It's not going to happen. One of the things on the list is that there is no contact between you and this other person, and you make sure that you let that person know this is permanent. The next thing on the list has to be total accountability, which is to say the offended spouse says, I have to have access to everything that pertains to your life without you fussing. If she wants to go look in his wallet at night, look in it. I want all your passwords. I want everything about your cell phone, the records. I want anything I ask for, you got to give me without fussing. If I want to drop in on your work in the middle of the day, you'd be happy to see me. If I want to ask you questions, if just at supper sometimes, point blank, just out of the blue, I want to look you in the eye and say, are you faithful to me? Have you broken your promise since I forgave you? Have you broken your promise in any way to me? And you have to answer it without fussing and tell the truth. That's got to be on the list. Total accessibility, total accountability, total honesty without fussing. Now, you get a man to sign off on this or a woman to sign off on this. And I believe that if he or she will maintain that you can put that marriage back together. And you know what? Trust will come back. Trust will come back. With reference to pornography, many of these things are still applicable. And accountability is so very important. This same thing about accountability ought to apply when you find out that your husband has been using pornography. He's got to repent of that awful sin. He's got to repent of it and come clean again. And accountability is something that will be very, very important. I can see that my time is gone. You've been very kind, and I appreciate you so much. And God bless all of our marriages, and God bless you as you try to walk the path of Jesus. You're dismissed.